Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to History Hack. You've got Zach and Beth with you today, the history sis bro duo in the house. Hello, Beth. How are you doing?
Hi, Zach. I'm good. You're right.
Yeah, I'm good. Who are we talking to today? Because we're kind of ish in my wheelhouse, aren't we?
It's partly both of us, really, isn't it? Because it's your like time period, I suppose, but the content is probably more my wheelhouse. So it's a nice mixture for the two of us. So we're joined by Sarah Jane Downing. Sarah Jane is an author and freelance journalist with particular interest in history and fashion and beauty. She's written widely on a variety of subjects for lots of different publications, with titles including Fashion in the Time of William Shakespeare and The English Pleasure Garden, 1660 to 1860. But today we get to talk to Sarah about her most recent publication, which is called Pastime and Pleasure in the Time of Jane Austen. So, Sarah Jane, welcome to History Hack.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
So, obviously, your book is called It's set in the time of Jane Austen. So we're looking at that early Regency period, the 1800s, 1820s, so on. And when I know when I certainly think of that time period and the wider Regency period, we often think of fashion as one of its identifying features, or I certainly do. We see in the Regency period the creation of now the pastime for the upper and middle classes. So we haven't got just this identifying feature as fashion, but we're looking at pastime as well, going to like the going promenading, attending art galleries and so on. Can you talk us through some of the social changes, the social and economic changes that were happening at this time that allowed for this introduction of doing something for fun rather than necessity?
Absolutely. Well, yes, I mean, things changed profoundly during this period. I mean, if you think about the continued time of war, you think about how everything is just absolutely completely different. I think the thing that is the most exciting great change is the advent of the fashion magazine. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to do this book in particular, because there are so many fantastic fashion plates that show a specific activity or a specific occasion that you might want to dress for in particular. And I think one of the most exciting things is that with the advent of the fashion press, you start to have a season by season fashion, so that you have got so many more options and so many more choices. And it starts to really sort of make you think in terms of, right, this is an opportunity to dress for this, rather than just, well, this is my favourite, I always wear this, so this is what I shall wear again.
So one of your particularly early chapters is entitled Pleasure in the Picturesque, which, as far as I understand, is essentially about how pastimes are taken in what we might call the great outdoors, you know, being seen out and about in a carriage, painting landscapes and so on. Was that as a concept kind of new to Jane Austen's era, or was it something that was kind of being done before the early 19th century, but only by a very select group because of things like affluence and opportunity and so on?
Definitely it was done before, but of course you had an awful lot of difficulties throughout the sort of the 18th century. It was when the advent of the Turnpike Road started to make travel so much better and so much more of a prospect. Because if you think about spending a couple of days in an uncomfortable carriage, jolting along terrible roads, it made the idea of travel far less appealing. suddenly at this point in time, you have got you've got the road system, which is starting to come into place. So it makes everything far more accessible. You also have a great idea of the fashion for carriages. And one of the fashion plates in the book is of the phaeton carriage. And it's absolutely gorgeous. It's really sort of, it's highly sprung. It's seated up high. It's very elegant. It's very pretty. And you start to have a selection of quite exciting different carriages and conveyances that people like to own and show off. And it's something of a signature, as in, you know, this is Lord so-and-so in his barouche and that sort of thing. So that also, I think, makes people feel more excited about going out. But I think that with William Gilpin, the idea of the picturesque, it starts to bring forward the idea of the landscape in a very different way. And so you've got an environmental sort of element like we have in our minds today. You have a terrible sort of situation as you go from the 1790s onwards into the 19th century. They enclosed millions and millions and millions of acres of land. And up until that point in time, you had a situation whereby, yes, you may own the land, but you would allow people who lived nearby to graze their animals there, or to come and gather firewood there, or to do things that were just, you know, you might consider to be way below anything that you'd like to be involved in or know about. But it was a lifeline for others who were living in a different way. At this point in time, you start to have the idea of the landscape, which is beautiful in terms of how you want to see your huge estate and how you want everything to be beautiful, meandering into the distance. Absolutely gorgeous, and I think very much part of what has made our green and pleasant land. But it did completely rob those people who were in a much smaller, more sort of pernicious existence of the lifeblood of being able to use someone else's land, the periphery, in a very different way. And so that's one of the great concerns. But also, because foreign travel is far less of an option because of war across Europe, people started to look at our landscape in a different way. And if you think about some of the romantic novels and the romantic poets that start to come through, it's a matter of engaging with the landscape in a way that is emotional and spiritual, as well as just, you know, oh, that's beautiful, as we drive past. And so going on lovely, wonderful long walks with a sketch pad or with a book of poetry was a different way of engaging with the environment and the landscape.
So is there a kind of a dichotomy here? Because you're talking about kind of a growing appreciation of landscape at a time when Britain's in its Industrial Revolution. And so what we're doing, we're carving up the landscape. You know, the first railways are about to get laid. The growth of kind of industrial towns. So you have this kind of really curious disconnect between we need to appreciate the landscape and yet also we need to kind of butcher the landscape for the sake of industrial growth. So how do they reconcile the two? Is industrialization this great kind of moral dilemma and it's going to have a corrupting influence on society? Is that how they think about it?
Yes, well, some people, I mean, as in our own time, we are very divided at the moment over things like HS2, aren't we? And some people are absolutely pro and other people are absolutely against. And it's very similar. You do have very entrenched positions from different factions. And yes, definitely a lot is written slightly later in terms of the damage that it is doing to the environment, the damage that it's doing to different sectors of society and how the lives of other people are changed.
Definitely. And then I suppose by extension of that, you've then got to talk about in the outdoors and using the land better. But people are finding new places, as you said, and one of those places seems to be like the seaside as well. Seaside really seems to be quite a popular choice for people to partake of their pastimes and so on. I mean, I know why I like the seaside. That's because I live 2 hours away from the nearest beach and it's a proper novelty for me to go to the beach. So why do you think 200 years ago that this was the case? You know, what kind of activities were they being undertaken there, and by who? Was it, again, these upper classes, or was it starting to filter down a little bit?
It takes a while for it to filter down, but yes, exactly. I think a lot of people felt, as you have described, yes, the exciting novelty of going to the beach, and definitely the most exciting thing. I mean, the idea of taking the waters, because of course we're at a very advantageous point for our health with the NHS and with. At that point in time, health is still quite a mystery. And if something besieges a person and they don't understand what, how, and why, it was quite horrifying, because, of course, people didn't know how that condition went into a point where it worsened and the person died. So things like taking the waters had been a very exciting sort of option for most people of all different walks of life. So the spa town had been had grown and become a huge thing in the later 18th century. But the seaside starts to take over, because the concept is not just to drink the waters, which of course were often quite hideous and unpleasant. And often it was a matter of not just 1 or 2 litres, but, you know, someone having to drink 3 litres of this horrible water each morning. So the idea of immersion was the thing that really attracted people to the seaside. And the idea of, again, as we're saying about the picturesque landscape, and we're saying about looking at that which is familiar, but in a different way. So the idea of actually engaging with the sea, not just for fishermen, and going out there and immersed in the seawater, experiencing a completely different part of the world that you would never normally voluntarily get into or go into. So that was very exciting, a huge novelty. And I think you had this wonderful sort of thing with the bathing machines, where you would be in a waiting area and you would have the opportunity to sort of see the bathing machine come up, privately descend into the water. And it gave an opportunity for women to bathe, because before, men had often been a little bit more sort of free and easy, and so long as there weren't too many people around, they would just go in. But the idea of protecting a woman from the gaze was very much to the fore. So hence the hooded machine, where the horse took them right out into the seawater so that they could be completely immersed undercover, privately and secretly almost. Because there were reports even at the time of people who were using what should be a nautical spyglass to look into the distance, training it on the machines to see if maybe there was any element of, could we see somebody?
Oh my.
So even in the 18th century, you have beach pervs.
I'm afraid.
Who knew?
Yes, isn't that terrible?
It is. Wow.
Yes.
Anything to see an uncovered ankle, clearly, during this period.
Those ankles.
Yes, quite. I'm quite conscious in this conversation, you know, I'm about 10 minutes away from the sea. So I am that person that you're jealous of, Beth. Sorry, not sorry.
I thought you were about to say, I am that person who looks for an ankle or two at the beach.
No.
Yes, indeed. It did look like that's where you were going with that, definitely.
So basically, my history sister is trying to expose me as a dirty man. Right, this wasn't where I expected this interview to go. I just want to pause for a second and just talk about that sort of growth of the spa town, because George III is quite significant in this, isn't he? I'm thinking particularly his connections with Weymouth, and him going to Weymouth for this whole purpose of, you know, taking the airs and the waters and so on. So is there this sense of the king's doing it, hey, this is a great idea, let's emulate it, or are lots of people kind of becoming aware that, okay, so we can go to the countryside, but hey, did you know there's this thing called the sea? It actually looks quite nice. You might want to try that as well. Or do both happen simultaneously?
Both happened. I think once the, because of course it was a slightly forbidden idea, because we're looking at, you know, being outside and being possibly well, in some cases naked, in other cases just with a robe to bathe in. So it's quite daring. And I think that's having that royal seal of approval was something that really allowed for people off the court or hopeful court circles to think, okay, right, if he is able to do it and that is okay, then that allows us to do it too. Then of course you do have the idea that this is a healthy thing and this is going to help to make people feel better, prolong and preserve their lives. So everybody is sort of thinking, right, okay, yes, it might be worth taking the plunge, so to speak. Terrible pun, I know.
And you talked also about going abroad. I mean, this is the era of the Grand Tour. How many people can afford to go abroad? And do you get kind of truncated versions of the Grand Tour so they don't take in all the sites, but they sort of, particularly once the war is over, post 1815, okay, people sort of start in 1814 and then Napoleon comes back and that's a whole rant for another day. But do you see people sort of just doing a little bit, you know, hop over, do Paris, maybe do Brussels, come back? Or is actually, is it a case that if you're going to do the Grand Tour, go do it properly or don't do it at all?
Well, that would be absolutely lovely. And I think a lot of people did think that if you don't make it to Constantinople, then you haven't been anywhere. But I think other people were much more sort of thinking, no, we've got 2 months. This is the time that we can spend. So this is how far we're going to go. And of course, you did also have people going and their money ran out when they got to a certain place. And so it's like, right, here we are. And of course, you had people who fell in love with certain places and thought, no, I don't really want to, I don't want to break the enchantment that I have here. I'd like to stay here a while.
I was moving away a little bit from sort of that travel and going to new places. Obviously, for those who maybe weren't able to do that, we see the development of, as in Pastimes and Pleasure, we talk about the growth of like theatre and the opera, those kinds of activities. I mean, I love going to like the theatre and I can only imagine how exciting like a trip up to London to see a play might have been. I think that would have been the height of adventure for quite a few people. Indeed, you know, Jane Austen makes mentions of it in her novels as well, doesn't she? You know, going up to London, seeing the shows, going to the, it's a big social event, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, as you'll see in that chapter, this beautiful gown, which is a theatre gown, and there are quite a few opera gowns. I don't know why there are more opera than there are theatre, except, of course, that at the opera, there was definitely a thing where people were not really, the way that, I mean, we would go to see an opera now and we immerse ourselves, we're quiet, we sit there, we enjoy the whole thing and drink it in. Yeah. Whereas at the opera, it was much more sort of, right, but I can see so-and-so over there and you might even troop over to go and visit so-and-so in her box. So especially if she is quite prestigious and she's got prestigious friends, because you might want to just be caught there at a time where someone who you'd like to get to know is there at the same time. So an introduction has to be made. So there's a real sort of exciting social sort of thing going on with the opera. Definitely, the theatre was brilliant. You have the change from where you had very, you think about, you know, Sarah Siddons, the great tragedian, and you think about the way in which theatre was consumed in very traditional, very traditional, very sort of formal kind of a way. And at this period, you start to have a wider range of theatres. And one that Jane visited herself was Astley's Amphitheatre. And that was known originally as a sort of theatre, almost, I guess, like a forerunner to music hall, where you've got a selection of singing, dancing, and just sort of out and out acts. And there's quite a lot because it was an amphitheatre. There's quite a lot of shows based around horses. So you've got sort of equestrian feats and events. You also have, at the time when Jane went, but she doesn't say whether she actually saw him or not, you've got little novelty things like Bobby, who was a pony, who would come out and boil a tea kettle and serve tea. How on earth he did it with hooves, I don't know. Yeah. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? Would you not just absolutely love to see that?
I mean, it would certainly be a sight to behold. I'm really confused.
I mean, I've seen somebody make a cup of tea using an articulated lorry, but the milk's already in by that point. So, I mean, the complexities of it.
I think means
let's move on,
because blown away by that.
We're scratching our heads a fair bit about that. Yeah. I like what you say though about, you know, it's about who you can get to see, but it's also about being seen, isn't it? You know,
absolutely.
Being seen associating with a certain person, and exactly. In some cases actually you don't want to be seen associating with certain people because of their reputation. What are the rules for women in terms of that, and the kind of the notion of the chaperone during this period? Because there are all kinds of kind of concerns, inverted commas, during this period about ladies' virtue and, you know, making sure that they are seen to conduct themselves in a way that society deemed, inverted commas, appropriate. So what are the rules when you're going to the theatre? Because presumably you can't go to the theatre alone. That would be sort of very, very scandalous. So talk us through that a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, you would go with probably a family party or a party of friends, and there would be strict invitations about whose party, you know, you would know all of the people who were going to be in your group, and it would all be very, very clear as to who was going with whom and what the relationships is. So that does allow for there to be some older members of the party who could act as chaperones, to be very careful, just in case, you know, you were waving at somebody over in the distance. To make sure that you know, that an exciting sort of introduction couldn't become too exciting. And there would definitely be a lot of attention paid to some of the people who would be there dressed in absolutely beautiful gowns, and a lot of whispering about, but who is she with? Because I saw her with so-and-so a moment ago, and now she's with so-and-so. So there is, I think, quite an opportunity for gossip there as well. And some people who were of an exciting sort of demi-reputation would like the idea that they had been associated with these different people, and it would be quite sort of exciting for them to be notorious. But on the whole, most people would be very, very strictly brought up, strictly sort of bound by convention, and any kind of whiff or suggestion that they had been involved with somebody who was not socially acceptable would be sort of, oh no, oh my goodness.
So hopefully fewer instances there of people sort of trying to catch sight of a uncovered ankle or something of that.
That's right. Indeed. Although, of course, you did have a faction of people who were, I suppose, on the fringes of prostitution, who would be there, and they would be quite keen to make sure that a beautiful ankle was shown.
Scandalous, scandalous. Let's move away before we fluster our listeners, because we're going to move on to a word that I cannot pronounce. Because you talk about something called phantasmagoria, which sounds like something out of Harry Potter, if I'm being really honest. So for the listeners who I'm guessing aren't going to know what this is, give us a quick rundown of the concept that you're talking about there.
The phantasmagoria is absolutely fascinating. If you think in terms of immersive art experiences that we have now, and if you think in terms of almost like your sort of haunted house kind of experience, so the phantasmagoria was something that in the just after the French Revolution, Etienne Gaspar did the first phantasmagorie in French in Paris. And the idea was that the visitors would descend down dark craggy steps by candlelight into a crypt that was abandoned. And the frisson of being in this terrifying darkness of the abandoned crypt, it was at a monastery. So it really, you think about Fuseli paintings, you think about the mysteries of Udolpho, and you think about the Gothic novels. It's that sort of feeling come to life. And then once there, all sort of, you know, frightened and giggling in the darkness, various apparitions appeared. And at that point, the first incarnation, it was apparitions who had been recently murdered during the Terror. And so the idea of seeing Marat and Robespierre and some of the other people who had been so pivotal in the revolution come to not come to life, but come to very sort of ethereal ghostliness in the darkness was absolutely stunning, terrifying, thrilling, all of those. And so they changed the concept slightly later on to be more of an Egyptian theme, because of course as you move away from the revolution and you get towards the turn of the century, we have the Egyptian campaigns and the Napoleonic Wars. So the whole idea of the mummy and the crypt and the Egyptiana is very much to the fore. So it's given a new sort of mummy in the crypt kind of tone. And the Phantasmagoria in London, they had an Egyptiana show as well. So you've got sort of spectres in the darkness, but you've also got mummies disturbed in their crypts as well. So if you want to be in a Gothic novel, this is how you bring it to life.
Wow. I'm interested in the origin of the concept. Is the idea to scare people, because obviously the whole thing is, you know, fear. Are they trying to instill people with a fear of the revolution? And is this kind of a latter phase of the revolution? You know, this is Robespierre. Robespierre was a piece of work. Fear him. You know, is that where they're going with this? You know, this phase of the revolution was bad. Be grateful that, you know, we've moved on from that. Is that the concept there, or am I just trying to read too much into that?
I think possibly it was more in terms of trying to come to terms with all that's happened and seeing those things distanced, but very much because of so much loss for revolution, for most families losing somebody. I mean, definitely revolutionary France, but also you think here as well, with the wars going on decade after decade, there isn't a family who hasn't lost somebody. So mourning is very much as part of everyday life, and I think it's allowing a group visitation to mourning, I think, is really what we're thinking of. And so that's lost in a tragic way, but that's also lost in a we moving on kind of way as well. So I think that's what they were doing with that incarnation of the Phantasmagoria.
Fascinating. Such a wonderful time. Like everything we're talking about, it's so fascinating. We also see in this period of time, don't we? You know, we talk about like the Enlightenment periods and so on, but I think in this period, this Regency period, the Jane Austen time, really see an opportunity for learning and advancing your own knowledge, you know, access to locations such as the Royal Academy, the Royal Institution. It's really a time of discovery and personal growth, I think. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is you see this in terms of people want to demonstrate what they know. They want to engage with everything. As we're saying about, you know, the landscape, looking at it in a different way, visiting Europe, looking at it in a different way. And so, yes, it's to show not only somebody as somebody who's of a very good, very traditional family, someone who's of a certain social class, or somebody who's of a certain level of wealth. It's a distinction again to show that, yes, this is somebody who knows and understands and engages with lots of exciting new concepts. And it's quite amazing to see it in different ways. And if you think about it in terms of in the Industrial Revolution, you've got people like Matthew Boulton, who are using the sort of demonstration of their exciting knowledge to do really cutting edge, quite literally, different things. I mean, like you think of the cut steel jewellery of the period. And so this is a demonstration of modern exciting methods, new knowledge, actually they're made glittery and beautiful for you to wear. So you've got a lot of the concept of displaying what you've learned, what you're learning and what you know.
Is there a lot of gatekeeping with that knowledge though? Because we're in an era of separate spheres, and you know, women are expected to be educated in things like geography and poetry and so on, so they can make nice conversation, whereas a man needs to be educated in manly things like science. And so, you know, if you as a woman wanted to attend a medical lecture or something, this would, I'm not sure you'd even get in the door. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Well, certainly, if you wanted to be educated and if you wanted to literally go and see this as a university lecture, then absolutely not. But no, I mean, we do know that Mary Shelley attended some of the medical lectures. And so it is I think the idea, if you went and you went with a group of respectable people and it was part of that, I think that would be regarded as fine, especially if you didn't take any notes. But I think if you had an interest beyond a passing interest, then I think that is where the gatekeeping comes in. And definitely you do have that weird dichotomy where, yes, to be well educated is a great virtue for a young lady, but to be well educated in terms of actually knowing things and being qualified in things and doing things, then the gate is slammed very firmly shut between the two.
Shock horror, you know, these women will be demanding the vote next or something utterly insane like that.
Yes, exactly.
It's interesting
for their boots there, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting suddenly Frankenstein makes so much more sense to me. And where the idea came from, now that I know that. That's fascinating. So we've got all of these exciting pastimes that are going on outside the home. But it was still important to have certain skills. And, you know, these might be sort of handicrafts, they might be sport, embroidery. Why was that still important to people during this era? And particularly, I suppose, for women of the Austen era, what would those pastimes actually do for them? You know, what practical use were they? Because, you know, you've got, if you're of a certain status, you've got maids and so on who can do many of these things for you if you really want to. So what's the thinking behind it all?
Well, I think that stems back to a much earlier era, and I think the idea of stitching and virtue go hand in hand. And so, I mean, the needlework is absolutely key in so many different ways, and so I think it's a lovely productive thing that somebody can do in a very safe enclosed space, and it shows that they are doing something with their hands, doing something with their mind, and doing something that's productive for other people. Because I think this is a great translation of a young lady's time into things for other people, which is quite interesting. And so you have in Mansfield Park, Fanny is making shirts for her brother. Jane and her sister did that for their naval brother. So you're showing closeness and love by producing something. So it's so much more special and intimate and caring than just simply having bought a garment, which of course these garments were not quite so readily available anyway, or having a maid or somebody make it. So you're really engaging and showing something special and sending something as a loving gift. You might be making gifts for other friends within your circle. Just Jane makes a beautiful little needle case, which is sent. an episode where somebody is making a needle case for someone, and she really isn't that interested in cultivating the friendship, and she really isn't that interested in completing the needle case. So it's sort of, yes, cursory embroidery on that one rather than rather than the full effort. But these are, you're also using it in terms of social glue in that respect, because you are making something for somebody, and this could just be as a friendship on a level, but it could be as a friendship that is being fostered to try to broker a closer friendship with somebody who's maybe slightly more socially desirable. So you're doing little things like that as well. Even sitting there with your embroidery or with your needlework, it's an opportunity to show your beautiful posture. It's an opportunity to show your elegant, lovely hands and delicate movements. And so even sitting quietly whilst guests are visiting other family members, you can be sort of showing how elegant and lovely and marriageable you are. So there's something there as well to just spending that time there. And then you also had things to show your virtue, and also, I mean, importantly, not just as a sort of cipher for the virtue, but literally making clothes for people who were the poorer people who were in your village or on your estate, making baby clothes to welcome people's, you know, new family members. Because of course, obviously, considering the time that you have to spend and the time that someone who is farming or doing something much more practical, the time they have to spend, it's only right that you can produce something as a beautiful gift to welcome that new baby.
Obviously, we've just talked about women and what was expected of them, but men also had particular pastimes that they found themselves partaking in, I suppose. Some of them have maybe more negative connotations: gambling, dueling, fighting, so on. Do you think maybe these activities, were they a way to like prove their masculinity, prove themselves to their peers, you know, that they were manly men who could fight their I don't know how you would like to say it, their I can't think of the word I'm trying to use, but to fight other men, you know, to prove how that they are a good match. Yes, potentially.
Yes, exactly. I suppose it's sort of vying to be an alpha, isn't it?
Yes. You know,
and I think there's quite a lot of demonstration of that. Yes, I mean, I think that there are two sort of quite interesting reasons for this. I think it dates back to a slightly earlier period where most men in more sort of noble and courtly circles were quite sort of effete in the way that they looked. If you think about the wig wearing and you think about, you know, makeup and little heels, and so you definitely have dueling dating back to that period, where I think it is something that would definitely be along that sort of theme. And of course, as you are in this period, you have got quite an interesting thought, because so many people are away participating in the wars, that I think for those who aren't, then maybe there was an attraction to doing these sort of, you know, manly things and demonstrating their masculinity in a very sort of singular kind of a way. And so, yeah, I do think there's quite a lot of that. But also, I think you have, this is a period where there isn't so much in terms of law enforcement. And so I think you've got things like showing that you are disapproving of one person's action against you. So, you know, if somebody slights a member of your family, you will offer them to a duel, because it is to defend their honour. And it is defend your honour to defend your honour, because you really have to take that role as one of the, you know, male leaders of the family. You have to show that you are there to defend everybody and to make things right for them.
The dueling thing is just insane. We could do a whole podcast just on that, frankly. If Alex was here, she would turn around and say, it's basically a massive pissing contest. Because in a way, it is. And there's this whole bizarre thing about the fact that it's not even legal for chunks of this period. Oh, so yeah. The army you're not meant to duel, but they all duel, and then they get caught out dueling, and they go, no, it wasn't me, Gov. And you get the witnesses in, and they go, I've got no idea how this guy ended up with a bullet in him. It's just a complete mystery. I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. So these cases collapse. It's just madness.
Everywhere else but the actual duel. I didn't see anything.
Yeah, I was out for a lovely walk. Yeah. I was admiring the landscape. That's what I was doing. I was being, you know, kind of virtuous and very 19th century.
Exactly. But you do have, like in Sense and Sensibility, it's necessary because there has been a slight on her reputation, and it cannot be put right unless she is, of course, I mean, because of, you know, the standards of the time, she isn't able to defend herself. She isn't able to put that right, and it can't be left as a wrong, because that will be taken as a mark upon her and possibly her family and her children and so on and so forth. So it's very important in terms of that sort of social kind of way, so that it has to be marked out. If a wrong has been done, a gentleman will make that right. And so even if you don't want to, you're obliged to have to do so.
There's another layer of nuttiness to this whole thing, which is that if you then go and fire on somebody, that's in some circles deemed unmanly. So if you aim to kill, then that's a real no-no. You shouldn't aim to kill. And yet at the same time, if you're not actually fighting, what's the point of you doing this whole thing in the first place? But like I say, that's an episode in its own right. We have to talk about fashion, right? And the fact that fashion was just important for the men as it was for the ladies. So let's talk about how the men are displaying their wealth. What are they doing during this period?
Well, it's great subtlety. And so it's all of these lovely distinctions that only another gentleman would be able to discern. And so it's perfect, it's subtle colours and perfect cuts, perfect fit. And if you think about the changes from the earlier sort of 18th century, where you have the French Revolution as a massive cutoff point, because all of those beautiful fashions, pink lace, wigs, and so on, all at that point are completely done away with, because you had at that point situation whereby if someone was still displaying those colours and styles of the ancien regime, they were, well, basically sort of sent up to the gallows and to the guillotine, and this is the end of it. It was termed as the Great Renunciation. And so this is where men are sort of renouncing their peacockness and their colours. And this is something that we embraced very wholeheartedly. We were never quite on these shores, never quite as flamboyant in the first place. But it's Beau Brummel who really changes things. And he takes what had been already in place in terms of the more subtle colours and the more subtle way of men being slightly more masculine. So you've got a lot of wearing of very, very tight trousers, very beautiful, shiny boots, but often quite sort of spattered with mud to be, you know, to show that you've just come in from a fantastic ride or from a carriage race or something like that. And you have got beautifully fitted shirts, jackets. The cravat is massively important. And there was so many things written about the correct way to tie a cravat, often with the help of a valet, because often you can only do it with somebody else to help you. And there are all these rules that Beau Brummel sets about how shirts and cravats have to be laundered, and it isn't good enough for them to just be laundered in London. They have to then be sent out to be dried on bushes or on the heath, so that they've got full fresh air, and they've got to be starched perfectly, and all of these wonderful sort of suggestions of how to do everything perfectly and properly. And so you go from having all of these great sort of expressions of wealth in a literal sense with silk and gold embroidery and fine lace and so on. So you think of the team it would take to make sure that every shirt and cravat was not just laundered, but also taken to be aired in the correct air, the correct location. And then someone to stand over you to help you make sure that the cravat was tied correctly. And this was a whole sort of process of having to have your head right up in the air to then gently crease it into perfect tiny little creases before it's finally tied. And everything has to be absolutely perfect white. So you are wearing gloves to do it, so there's no chance of any kind of smudge. And so it's a different way of making the statement in a much more subtle way. And the Prince Regent takes his cues from Beau Brummel, so everybody else does too. And so
And obviously when we think about this time period, and anyone who's read a Jane Austen novel or seen one of the TV or film adaptations, romance and the prospect of marriage is extremely important, you know, very practically for women. It's avoiding destitution, homelessness, you know, relying on your family members. For men, obviously, it's a necessity of carrying on the family name. What kind of pastimes would the young men and women of the time have been expected to participate in so that they secured these matches? Because I suppose not all pastimes were just for pleasure, it was for practical purposes as well.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's a very good point. For instance, if you are of a certain sort of social standing, you have an obligation to make sure that you throw balls and events, dances and things, so that people have the opportunity to come together. And so this was a very important obligation for each family, you know, county families, families of the town. And so the dances are really your key sort of opportunities, but there are lots of other little opportunities, as we're saying, you know, joining a party in the theatre. So it's quite possible that your mother would make sure that the mothers of several eligible bachelors were invited so that they could then bring their sons. And there would be an awful lot of networking amongst family members to try to get the best possible connections for those offspring. I mean, think of Pride and Prejudice, you know, think of all the Bennet girls and how much effort they would have to make to try to court all of the best families to make sure that they have introductions for all of those daughters. But yes, definitely social events of all kinds, but dancing more than anything. And I really, from a child onwards, you start to learn how to dance properly, and that's proper deportment, and that's being able to participate in all of the most sort of popular and fashionable dances, so that you can always be putting yourself in the way of the most eligible choice. So you can sort of be like, yes, see how pretty I look. Look at my lovely sewing. Look at my pretty, no, not my pretty ankle, but look at my pretty wrist, my lovely fluttering fan. And so.
See, you'll have flustered all of our listeners again with that mention of that ankle, you know.
I know.
All of those men who would be standing on beach cliff tops with their spyglasses. Yeah, no, they're struggling right now. There's a section of your book that looks at some of the what Beth, when she was writing the questions, termed sauciness. because unfortunately we're starting to run out of time, I'm gonna make people go and read the book to find out about the things like the prostitution that gets highlighted, the secret sex clubs, which sounds like a whole story in itself, and the influence of alcohol. But there is a downside to that behavior, some of it fairly logical, you know, sexually transmitted infections, drunkenness, fighting, eloping, all of which actually ends up being highlighted in Pride and Prejudice. So it's not all fun and games. Just give us some teasers to make people go and buy the book. You know, some of the stories that you've written about, and just a hint of the sauciness, as Beth calls it.
Oh my gosh, I don't know where to start. I feel a little bit embarrassed now being put on the spot. It's one thing writing it, it's quite another thing talking about it. But I think, as we were saying earlier, you do have this very, very strange dichotomy where everything is so beautifully well organized and regimented most of the time. I think it's almost to be able to break out. And we all do this to a certain degree. I don't think there's anybody who hasn't taken time off from their studies or their exams to go to a club and maybe drink much too much and that sort of thing. Yes. So I think it...
Far too many times.
Beth is nodding, you can see this. Yes, me too. And so I think we all have that sort of compulsion to break out and to do something that maybe isn't the most sensible thing, but can be an awful lot of fun. And so one of the things that really stands out as a particular Regency thing, and it's awful when you think about it, but this whole idea of the cutting a rule. And so you have these young gentlemen who have got together who are basically, it's practically a rampage. It's drinking to a huge, huge, crazy degree, 3 bottles of port in a night. And then it's going out and sort of, you know, being very loud and boisterous. And you had the night watch during the era rather than a police force, per se. And so you'd have these little sort of constables in almost like sentry boxes on various corners throughout the city. And one of the great things that they loved to do was be to sort of sneak up behind where the night watchman might have dropped off to sleep somewhere late at night, and tipping the box over so that he's trapped inside it on the pavement, which is absolutely awful. But they seem to take great pleasure in doing this and running off giggling and going off to the next pub.
On to the next one.
Absolutely. And so people would sort of then meet late at night. I think, you know, instead of a kebab shop, it would be an oyster room. And so at the very end of the evening, people, after having had many, many drinks in different places and having all sorts of adventures, would meet up and have oysters and try to chat up one of the lovely oyster serving girls who, gosh, must have been completely sick of all these drunks coming in and flirting, and yes, would often end up there having this, you know, fantastic slap-up meal, or maybe falling asleep at the table before having to sort of stumble off in time for depends if it's been a good night, just to go home. If it's not been a good night, for the dueling at dawn.
Absolutely. Sarah Jane, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about the contents of your book. So for our listeners, please tell them where they can get it and when they should get it, which should be immediately after listening to this podcast.
Oh, that is the best recommendation. Absolutely. Yes, that would be fantastic. Yes, the book came out on the 15th, so it's only been out a couple of days, and it's available on Amazon and all other good retailers online and in the real world. So yes, it'd be fantastic. Well, I am doing an official book launch if anybody would like to come and get a book, get it signed. And with that, I'm doing a talk about some of the themes in Pastimes and Pleasures. It's at Astley Book Farm in Warwickshire, which is sort of, it's right out in the country near to Nuneaton. And tickets will be available from the Astley Book Farm website and from my website as well, which is sarahjanedowning.co.uk. And the launch and the talk is on the afternoon of Saturday, April 23rd. So it would be delightful if you'd like to come.
And I will just say to folks, Don't go to Amazon and give Jeff Bezos his business. Was it Ambly who published this?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so people, either go to Ambly's website and order it direct, because Sarah Jane will then actually see some of the royalties rather than being turned into a puff of smoke as Jeff Bezos goes on his latest trip to space. Or you can go to the History Hack bookstore where, as you know, because I tell you often enough, Sarah Jane gets her cut, History Hack gets a little cut, and then also you support independent booksellers. So you've got two options there. Go direct to Ambly or help everybody out effectively and check out the bookstore. There will be a link in the description. Sarah Jane, this has been absolutely brilliant. We could have talked for another hour, frankly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful fun. Thank you.